Joe me if I really need to know.
Good morning, and welcome to the Wednesday, April 5th, 2017 meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade. We have a number of items on our docket for today. So without further ado, we will begin with a public hearing on House Bill 3213, which has to do with broadband infrastructure and reporting. And Mr. Crawford, could you please give us an introduction while Representatives Nathanson and Holvey come forward to do an orientation for us? And I'll open a public hearing on this bill, House Bill 3213.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3213 requires a report submitted to the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council to the Joint Committee, Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management to include the role of broadband technology in local, state, and regional economies and economic development. The bill currently has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13. I started off this morning with a little bit of a chuckle when my legislative aide brought out the folder for me, and I found the information about the Oregon Datafication Conference held at Oregon State University in 1995, and here I am listed in the event as one of the speakers. So I've been following this topic for a few years. I've been very interested in the importance of technology and access to the internet for, as you can see, a long, long time. I also pulled out a newspaper article that was reporting on a recent FCC Federal Communications decision where they classified broadband internet service as a utility. And that's really the foundation of the point I want to make today, which is internet access isn't about fun or convenience or an extra. It's every bit as important as utilities. This bill proposes to add 15 words to the current statute. Its importance, though, I believe, surpasses its simplicity and brevity. Broadband technology is an essential ingredient for all local economies in the state, and indeed essential for Oregon to stay competitive in the national economy. High-speed internet access attracts and grows new businesses, keeps what businesses we do have, and is one of the most powerful tools we have for economic and workforce development. Just like water, power, and roads were essential infrastructure in the last century, internet access is the essential infrastructure for this century. The internet transports data like highways and rails transport goods. It shapes our businesses and their opportunities for competition and growth. The delivery of internet access for business purposes and economic development is a key factor in determining where to locate or whether a technology business can expand in its current location. They need access, of course, to roads, airports, water, sewer, and power, but they need high-speed internet access as well. The Broadband Advisory Council is doing a great job with its mission and what the legislature has asked them to do in statute, to report to us on affordability and accessibility, specifically on the use of broadband in telehealth, energy management, education, and government. But I think we're missing the boat. We should be paying much more attention to the role of broadband in economic activity and community development generally, and we can start by updating our direction to that council. At the Oregon Business Plan Summit in 2015, we heard community perspectives gathered from the regional economic forums in regions of the state the previous year. More than half of the 11 economic regions listed enhanced broadband distribution as essential for their region and that the access that they do have needs work. Those regional meetings included South Central in Klamath Falls, Eastern Oregon in Ontario, Mid Willamette Valley in Monmouth, South Willamette Valley in Eugene, North Coast in Astoria, and North Central in the Dalles. All of those regions are saying that we need to focus on broadband. Oregon has more than 3,400 tech industry firms, including software firms, video game developers, and biotech companies. And just about every business in Oregon depends on broadband now, whether they are selling to customers 20 miles or 2,000 miles away. Tech companies employ 78,300 people statewide, and the industry has grown by more than 10% a year for the last 5 years. This is serious business and serious economic activity. Oregon tech companies are competing with the Bay Area and Seattle for talent and business, and they're competing based on what internet access they have also. They rely on high-speed internet access to stay competitive. We need to help them do that. So this statute just makes a simple proposal. It amends the mission of the Broadband Advisory Council. It amends their reporting duties to direct it to report also on the role of broadband technology in economic development and its role in state, local, and regional economies. That's all. I just think it's very important that we stay on top of this and get ahead of it. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, welcome, Representative Holvey, and then we'll have questions opportunity afterwards.
Thank you, Chair Leininger, committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to speak in front of your committee again. And for the record, my name is Paul Holvey, State Representative of District 8, which is South Eugene and South Central Lane County. I joined on with this bill with Representative Nathanson. Have some personal experience in my district where broadband, you know, can really change a community. The city of Bonita, which is about 14 miles west of Eugene, has really struggled with their community as their economy has changed. And broadband was something that they targeted as being something critical to their economic development. It not only enabled them to attract some small business, but also it has the added benefit of allowing some entrepreneurs, self-employed folks to work from home if they had the adequate internet speed. You know, we're talking, you know, 1 gigabit up, both up and down, you know, a truly reciprocal speed is really something that's, you know, pretty important for business opportunities. And so when I first looked at this issue and really tried to help, you know, the city of Bonita and you know, kind of being a cheerleader for them to get somebody in there that could provide higher speed internet for their business plan, their economic plan for their community, it became apparent to me that not only did it have that advantage of helping build their local community, but it helped reduce the traffic commuting back and forth to Eugene because people were able to perform these jobs in rural parts of the county without having to commute into the center of the city. So I sort of looked at that and says this is really a rural economic development opportunity if we could figure out how to expand broadband into more areas of the state. I thought so much of it last session. I introduced a bill to create taxing districts, municipal broadband taxing districts, thinking this was a really great idea. I still think it's a great idea, but it ran into something called compression. And, you know, that sort of took the wind out of the sail of that concept. But I still just want to stress how important, you know, high-speed internet is. As Representative Nathanson alluded to, you know, our economic development of many of our smaller communities, especially satellite communities, and I see that as just a win for all the way around for, you know, the trying to reduce the amount of traffic going in and out of commuting and also, you know, giving those smaller communities a leg up and trying to compete in a new economy that's internet-based. So I think that this is really a great idea to really try to focus a little bit more on the economic impacts of people's access to high-speed internet broadband. So I just commend this bill to you and hope you'll look favorable upon this one.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Do we have questions for these presenters? Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning. Thanks for bringing us an issue that's critically important to particularly our rural small business economies. My question is about redundancies. I've often had the sense that somebody sticks a shovel in the ground in Tualatin and suddenly the internet service at the coast goes down. And that doesn't mean that we can't access Facebook or YouTube. It means cash registers go dark. We can't take hotel reservations. We can't ship packages at the post office. I understand the priority is to get faster service throughout Oregon, but have you also talked about the issue of backup redundancy on our service availability?
Madam Chair and Representative Gomberg, yes, the issue of redundancy is very important. In Eugene, I've talked to several local business people who absolutely need it because it's mission critical for the reasons that you said. And that's why Eugene is now very happy to host another alternative means of access to the internet, and I hope that there's a presenter you'll hear from in a few minutes who can describe that for you. Partly it's an issue of availability at all, what speed is available. In part, when you introduce a little competition, when other providers start realizing they can come into a community, sometimes the competition serves to help bring down the price. But even more importantly, for at least one or two of the businesses I talked to, they absolutely needed the redundancy because they couldn't afford for what they provide for their customers who are not, they're not local customers. They're virtually, they could be virtually anywhere in the world. They needed it. The continuous service, not the possibility of what you described.
Thank you. And Representative Gomberg, I think, you know, if we really got the word out that people should call first before they dig, it would it would be helpful to those scenarios.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Reschke and then Representative Brockman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gomberg stole some of my thunder because Lakeview only has one line that goes directly to it, and that's it. And they've had times when they go dark because somebody does dig, and they have no access for the hospital, police force, the whole city just goes dark as far as the information age. My question, though, to you is, could you give us an example how your 15 words, what will this accomplish, or can you give us an example of what that might look like in the report?
Madam Chair and Representative Reschke, I can't anticipate whether the report would now expand by two paragraphs or 20 pages. I certainly hope that what it means is the Council will now study the additional topic that is proposed in this bill. What is the role in the economic development of our communities and our state? Because right now, their role is limited to reporting on, for example, telehealth, education, government, so forth. It's very limited areas, and I think it completely ignores the responsibility that I believe we have as a state to say, how are we doing with providing this critical infrastructure, which I think is as critical as a utility. As you've pointed out, if internet access goes down, a lot of stuff goes down, the same as if a water main broke or we lost power. So I believe it should influence their work for the next year and years ahead, and I believe that it will benefit the legislature in making policy decisions on whether it's regulatory or where to make financial investments. If we help communities build water mains or repair sewers, should we help communities also with internet infrastructure? That's one example. It could lay the foundation for that.
And just to follow up with that, if I may, I think Representative Nathanson is absolutely correct, but I think that one of the main parts these 15 words will do will sort of drive the discussion to help us identify the economic potential of just broadband in certain areas around the state, which I would assume would make investors much more comfortable about the return that the community would see in establishing broadband. So I think that's one of the huge pieces of those words is, you know, we'll understand what the potential is for the economic impact and, you know, which would help people make decisions about making those investments.
Thank you.
Excellent. Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And more of a, just a comment or a question. My colleagues have heard this before, but in my former life, I appreciate the bill, but in my former life, I was the chamber president for many years, and we had a subcommittee within the chamber to look at high-speed internet access. We didn't have high-speed internet access in Port Orford, my hometown, until I think 2009. And it was because of a woman who worked for Verizon, who stayed at a local retreat, that we finally got a hold of that one person, and we called one person every day for about 2.5-3 years. And she said, "What do you mean you don't have high speed? Well, let me get back to you." And about a half hour later, we should have everything taken care of in 2 weeks. And so we actually had a sign up and had 650 people register for internet to get away from dial-up. And the UPS had to send two trucks up just to drop off the little modems for everyone to hook up. And as you had mentioned earlier, it allowed the competitive market to come in. And so then Charter, of course, worked to create route redundancy over 199 so we could eliminate that problem because we had a situation where our credit card, you know, somebody could dig on Highway 42 out towards Bandon, and then suddenly everything, all commerce shuts down. And now we have some of the fastest high speed on the coast, or in Oregon, really, that runs through Curry County and my district. So I appreciate the bill. I appreciate what the information that it's going to provide, and you're exactly right in your conversation. So just wanted to share.
Okay. Great. All right, thank you. Any other questions for these proponents? All right, thanks so much for being here. And I now have the pleasure to call forward Ann Fifield, who I haven't seen for 20 or 25 years. Oh, we'll forget that. Never mind. Nice to see you.
It's
welcome.
Nice to see you.
Please start by stating your name for the record.
Thanks very much for having me. My name's Ann Fifield, and I work in economic development at the City of Eugene. And I'm here to express support for House Bill 3213. And I'd like to echo a lot of the statements made by Representatives Nathanson and Holvey. First, I'd like to clarify some of the jargon. The word broadband is a flexible term that's used to describe fast telecommunication service. It's that word broadband has, what is broadband has steadily increased over the last 20 years as technology has improved. Today, fiber optics are the state-of-the-art technology to deliver broadband service. A big part of my job in Eugene for the last 2 years has been to implement our downtown fiber network. And the city has partnered with our local electric utility to build an open access fiber network in our downtown. The fiber network is the city's top economic development priority. We see fiber as an essential tool to increase the number of jobs and the average wage for jobs in our region. Eugene's fiber network is greatly expanding internet connectivity. The buildings that are now part of the network have gigabit service. That means 1 gigabit per second, or 1,000 megabits per second, which is much better than what most people get at their homes. And the price tag for this service of gigabit service is $99 a month. Fast service and its affordable rates are our infrastructure for the 21st century. Quality telecommunications service is essential infrastructure for the 21st century, in the same way that having a freeway on-ramp was essential infrastructure in the 20th century and a railway stop was essential infrastructure in the 19th century. The lack of quality telecommunications service will limit our economic prosperity throughout the 21st century. The city of Eugene has seen some very positive outcomes from our small fiber network. So far, we've only completed a pilot project. We've hooked up about 7 buildings. We're in the process now of building out the full network throughout the downtown. And in our small pilot project, we've had some real positive outcomes. For example, there's a growing tech firm that recently relocated from North Eugene in a small office to a larger space in downtown Eugene, and they came to downtown Eugene because they wanted to be on the fiber network. They stayed in town. They didn't relocate to someplace else. Another firm has told us recently that if they could connect to the network, then that expanded telecom service would allow them to take on a new project with an existing client. That project would require that they hire 40 people. But to create those 40 jobs, they need broadband service. These examples are both local startup companies, homegrown in Eugene. As the city of Eugene has worked to apply for non-local grant funds to construct the network, local businesses have provided letters of support for our various grant applications. One application, we had 18 businesses write letters for us, and those 18 businesses estimated that they could create 215 new jobs if they had this telecommunication service. The jobs are good jobs. Their average wage is $17,000 a year more than our average median wage today. It's definitely a way to improve our average wage and our local economic prosperity. In Eugene, we have seen real evidence of how quality telecommunications infrastructure positively affects our economy. If any of you have any doubts about the role that broadband does play in economic development, I would like to invite you to come visit our little network down in Eugene. I would be happy to show you the infrastructure and introduce you to some of our growing businesses that are using that infrastructure.
Thank you. Do you have any questions for Ms. Byfield?
Well, that's great. I'll note that in Clackamas County, when I was a county commissioner during the Great Recession, we sought and secured several million dollars in funding from the federal government to help support build out of internet connectivity to some of the more rural communities in Clackamas County. And we have heard that it has been a really powerful tool for people who live in small and more remote communities to launch and sustain businesses. So from every angle, it seems like a really great opportunity. Thank you for being here.
All right. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. With that, I will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3213. I would welcome a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3213 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Brock Smith moves House Bill 3213 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. And let's have Representative Nathanson be the carrier. All right. Now we will close the work session on House Bill 3213 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3374. And I believe Representative Brock Smith is going to come forward and assist with our orientation to the bill.
Yes, and I believe Gil Riddell from.
And also Mr. Riddell. Wonderful. I want to note that we do not have the paperwork to move the bill today, but this is an important opportunity to learn about it and ask questions. This bill has a referral to the House Committee on Revenue, so like a number of the bills that we hear in this committee, this is not the final destination for, not the final place where evaluation is done. So you can keep that in mind. Welcome, Representative Rocksmith.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Committee, David Rocksmith, State Representative, House District 1, Charleston to Brookings to West Cape Junction, up to West Roseburg, Melrose, Looking Glass. This bill is something that I've been working on for a long time. As many of you know, I'm a former county commissioner for Curry County. Curry County is one of the 18 ONC counties that have lost their federal funding with regards to the Secure Rural Schools payments, and we're in a situation of dire straits, really. As a county commissioner, I actually put forth four funding solutions to try to raise revenue to fund services in Curry County, which, of course, in my neck of the woods isn't a very palatable thing to do. But it's what was right. We are in a situation where our looming budget deficit is in upwards of $3 million for this biennium. Now, mind you, the total budget for the county minus the road department is roughly $7 million, so that's a little less than half. Now, when you think about the tax revenue that's generated in Curry County, you have to think about the property that's in Curry County, and that is there's 1,648 square miles in Curry County, 67% of which is owned by the federal government. 22% is private timber. 7% is farmland. 1% is state, and that only leaves roughly 5% of economically developable and taxable land in Curry County. So to put it in perspective, to generate roughly $4.5 million, or what is needed to just keep the county at its limited inadequate levels of service today, you would need over 80 abandoned, the taxes from over 80 abandoned dunes style golf courses. You would need over 4,000 McDonald's franchises. We currently have one. So I just hope to use that information to put things in perspective. Added to the difficulty with regards to the less than 5% of economically developable land, you then put a Highway 101 through it and add Goal 18 with regards to the Coastal Shores boundary, and you're in a situation where it's a recipe for disaster. Hence, the ONC Act and, of course, what occurred in what Senator Hatfield did and then what Senator Wyden did with Secure Rural Schools. Those payments are gone. They ended technically in 08 and then were on a down step of payments from 08 to 12. There were two partial extensions, emergency extensions to 14 and 15, and then they are no longer. And every conversation coming back from D.C. is that they will never be again, at least in the form of what is called Secure Rural Schools. Hence, House Bill 3374. I believe many of you might have seen the news articles that came out of Josephine County, Oregon, which is also my district, Monday morning, where the sheriff, due to budget cuts, is laying off all of his patrol division and closing his patrol division. So Josephine County will no longer have sheriff's deputies to respond to crimes or to anything, and will only be able to handle mandated services such as corrections and civil responsibilities. This is just unacceptable in today's society. What House Bill 3374 does is it sets up a fund that when a county is willing to help itself by passing a local option to raise revenue to fund services, this fund will match 50% of the money generated up to what was paid in Secure Rural Schools payments in the last year of 2008. So for Josephine County, that would be Josephine County would historically get his their 08 ONC payment was $12,600,000. So 50% of that would be $6 million. Josephine County has a and has been attempting to pass funding solutions to fund services to its citizens, as have Curry, and they have not been successful. I don't know, and I can tell you from past experience, I don't know how we're going to be successful. But public safety and the safety of our citizens is the most important job as an elected official. And as the state of Oregon, it's important that all of our counties and the citizens are safe, not for only the people that live there, but the people that travel there. And you're in a situation in Southern Oregon right now where that is going to be a case of grave concern. You're also in a situation where local electeds are having serious problems in some areas and creating serious problems in others. To put that in perspective, before I left my position as a county commissioner for Curry, the chair of the board, who still is there, when the sheriff was asking if he can create a committee through the local public safety coordinating council, and if the board would do so, the chair of the board, who is the chair now, told the sheriff, and I'll paraphrase, that the sheriff is confused on what his job as a county commissioner is, and it is not to look for revenue to fund public safety services to citizens. And so that is the, for lack of a better word, mentality of the situation that is occurring down there, and it's growing every year with every new election. This bill is really, you know, some would consider it a handout. I consider it a hand up. We have a situation where our tax rates are low. But our tax rates are low because the majority of our lands are federally owned. And the ONC Act clearly states that they should be managed to generate revenues to assist in funding services to citizens. And as I explained earlier, in Curry, for example, there isn't the land to generate the revenue needed to fill the gap. Over 4,000 McDonald's, right? There's 22,373 people that live in Curry County. Thank you.
Thank you for that presentation, Mr. Riddell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I've submitted material on OLIS for you to look at. I will move quickly through it. AOC strongly supports this bill and asks that you move it forward to the House Revenue Committee. House Bill 3374 provides a reasonable incentive for self-help for voters of 10 counties that were hammered by the dramatic change in federal forest management policy in the 1990s and the consequent adoption and expiration of the safety net called Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act of 2000. Why are so many counties in fiscal distress? I've put some data before you. For several counties, the County Permanent Property Tax Rate Authority, which is a matter of discussion for the House Revenue Committee, but it is permanent due to Measure 50 of 1997, is too low. I've listed 13 examples. Representative Brock Smith has mentioned Josephine and Curry, and they're right at the top, under 60 cents a thousand. Contrast the mean tax rate imposed by counties that to that of cities and special districts. I've listed those. County mean tax rate statewide is 2.82 cents per thousand. Cities is $5.44 per thousand. And K-12 to ESD is $6.92 per thousand. County Property Tax Administration is the engine to produce revenue for public services for local taxing districts. Yet the percentage of collections retained by county services, including the job of collecting and administering these property taxes, is often inadequate. I've given you six examples, and Curry and Josephine are at the top again. The statewide mean of property tax shares by type of districts that are retained by type of districts is listed, and you'll see K-12 ESDs keep 41% of the taxes collected by counties, cities 21%. I've also posted on your site a brief history of direct property tax administration cost sharing, which illustrates the imperfections of the state assessment and taxation funding program over time, and that, again, is a matter for the House Revenue Committee. But I wanted to make one point for this committee. At its creation in 1989, it was assumed that this source would provide 35% of the cost of local property tax administration. In reality, it's reached that mark only three fiscal years and has settled in at an inadequate 20% of the cost, annual cost, of local property tax administration. Another reason for chronic county fiscal distress is that several counties are forced by location to be dependent on federal forest management policy decisions, federal forest receipts, and safety net payments when they do occur. I've listed the following figures below on that page. They're dated, but they're still representative. And you'll see that some of these numbers can be jaw-dropping, particularly with the O&C counties. If Douglas County lost safety net payments in the year fiscal year 2006, and it hasn't changed that much, they would lose nearly 70% of their general funds, and so it goes. Josephine and Curry again on top. Road fund loss is just as dramatic, and the 15 counties I've listed, and some of them are not included in the other list. Representative Brock Smith mentioned, federal forest safety nets have expired. And I might need some help from Donna. Looks like. That do it? Yeah. Okay. The and this is on your committee records as well. The blue line is the safety nets over time, and you see the declines that Representative Brock Smith mentioned. The payments that are in red are actual harvest receipts, and that's what is being paid now to counties that are being dominated, that are dominated by federal forest lands. Without the safety net, the national forest payments to county road funds based on actual revenues for federal fiscal year 2012, which was $4.8 million, would have been 10% of the safety net payment. Without the safety net, O&C and Coos Bay Wagon Road payments, and these are general funds for counties, based on actual harvest in federal fiscal year 2013, about $18 million would have been only 48% of the safety net payment. Why are federal forest payments so important? Well, it's all about location, and if you look at this map, produced by Department of State Lands. The white areas are private lands and are taxable, but 97% of them are in farm or forest deferral. The other colors, which dominate the map, are public lands that are not subject to property taxation. So there's relatively very few lands to tax, and those that are taxable are not taxable at the full value. This map illustrates the federal land ownership by county. The deeper the red, the more the federal land. And you can see the counties that have a lot fewer options at hand to provide self-help. Finally, in your materials, I've listed the four current statutes related to county fiscal distress, and I want to note only that the first one I've listed addresses public safety emergencies and is scheduled to sunset January 2nd, 2018. My thanks to the chair for introducing House Bill 3434 to extend the sunset to 2024. And with that, I'm through, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you so much. Representative Marsh, this is really helpful orientation, and hopefully we'll have a good conversation about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then Representative Lewis.
My internet search indicates that there were 33 of 36 counties that received some kind of rural schools funding. How are you carving out the 10 that you're proposing to include in this bill?
Well, and Chair, and Vice Chair, the bill does that, and it's based on those counties that had 10% received payments that were greater than 10% of the total property taxes that were imposed on the county, on the county itself. And there are 10 counties that that fit that category, and I can go through them quickly. Benton, Coos, Curry, Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, Klamath, Lane, Lynn, and Polk. And I hope that's responsive. That's based on the language in the bill.
Are those? I'm sorry. No,
please go ahead. Yeah.
Are those listed someplace in all this documentation?
No, actually, I just looked through the materials and listed them by hand. But I'm happy to follow up with a list for your records. Very simple.
Thank you, Mr. Riddell. Representative Brocksmith, did you have? I believe that the list I saw from you had maybe Yamhill and Tillamook counties also?
Correct. And so this was, thank you, Madam Chair. This was a list that my staff and I put together. I hadn't confirmed it with LRO yet, so I didn't want to put it in OLIS.
So it could be that Tillamook and Yamhill are included, possibly not, though, depending on a review of the numbers. But
correct.
It would be helpful, I think, if we could put on OLIS after the meeting at the point at which it folks have a chance to feel like they've confirmed what the counties are that would be affected. And again, given the potential fiscal impact, it would always be possible to narrow the number of eligible counties. I believe that Clackamas, where I live, Washington, and a couple of additional counties are not on the list based on this 10% threshold. You know, which I think is, you know, you have to draw the line somewhere, and I see that as a somewhat reasonable choice.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And the largest counties that are on the list are, of course, Lane and Jackson. But the reason they are is because of the 10% threshold. Although Jackson County generates in their taxes levied at $37 million, they historically received in their 08 payment a $16 million in SRS dollars. And Lane County at $39 million, received $15 million in ONC tax dollars. ONC dollars.
Representative Marsh, do you feel like you had a chance to thoroughly ask your question, or would you like to do a follow-up, and then we'll go to Representative Lewis?
I've asked my question. I think at some point, if we move this forward, we would really want to have some conversation about narrowing this list down. Some of these counties I don't think need to be on it, quite frankly, are doing well, which is perhaps an example for the other counties.
And I believe an easy or the easiest amendment for that would be to move the 10% threshold to 2025. Go.
Well, Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair, what I can do is give you counties and the percentage that would be that would correlate, and then the committee could decide where to make the cutoff. We just name the counties and the percentage.
I just wonder if we want to come up with some other criteria. I mean, my own county, I'm speaking against my own best interests here. I hope nobody's watching this, but we have, you know, a whole lot of a very high percentage, 16 out of 37, right? And yet Jackson County has money in the bank, has been well managed, has established a library district. People have stepped up. It's an example of a county that's really pulled itself together after the decline of payments from the federal level. I can't see any reason why the state, from an objective external point of view, should provide a handout to Jackson County.
I would, Madam Chair, I would agree. Again, the 10% threshold was the starting point.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to have the conversation with the committee so that you could see how we began, so that this could be a bill that can be worked by all of us. Just as you pointed out, the various taxing districts, such as the library district, Curry County has over 40 taxing districts. We have over 5 library districts. We've done all of those things. We've shed off, of course, those services into standalones, and over the last about 30 years. So,
Madam Chair, I will work with the Vice Chair and set up a list so that you can make a logical decision.
Thank you, Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have 2 questions. I'm looking at a portion of this bill where it talks about the grants would be made to any county based on the number of years that the levy is for. So, like, let's say it's a 3-year levy. So it would be each of those years, it would be a 50% match from the state?
Correct.
Okay, or 5 years, whatever the maximum is. Okay, thank you. And second
Please.
Question, Madam Chair, what is the ONC funds, we've known for at least 15 years, if not longer, that those funds are going away. Yeah. What kind of regional planning is being done for a long-term solution for this? Are there any regional planning groups working on a solution?
Well, me too.
Go ahead.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Lewis, there's a current planning process for the ONC counties lands by the Bureau of Management, Department of Interior, and it has now been litigated. So, unfortunately, it had to go into the judicial process, which will take some time. There was a previous plan. It was unacceptable to the previous administration, so they started over. And this one, the contention is from the counties, the ONC Association, is that it does not acknowledge the statutory statement that the leading purpose of these lands is production of timber and community sustainability. Therefore, they sued. So that's where we are. And they have no safety net. The planning they're doing would be up to the individual counties, and I am not in position to say what specific remedy, short-term or medium-term, that each individual county is undertaking. Sorry.
I can, Madam Chair, I can just add to,
please.
Other counties have. When I was a county commissioner, we looked for bridge funding until the ONC issue is fixed. The ONC Act clearly states that that the 2.5 million acres of ONC lands within the state of Oregon will be managed for sustained yield, and 50% of that of those revenues will go to, at a minimum of 500 million board feet a year, and 50% of those revenues will go to fund county services. We're in a situation where, no one's ever happy with the management bills, as Mr. Riddell previously mentioned. We've went forward and tried to do the Deschutes County model, where they've created law enforcement districts, and that was a non-starter. We have tried to coordinate, and I've already mentioned we've moved our services off to special taxing districts, and or we've even went as far as moved our public and mental health departments to a standalone services, and combined departments such as juvenile and parks and all of these counties have. Douglas County is closing its libraries because they can no longer fund the services, and that's happening, and they put out a levy to the citizens to see if they are willing to fund them, and they weren't, and so they're closing.
I'm going to make a comment and then go to Representative Clem, please. I think that the question that Representative Lewis asked and Rep. Marsh's comment raised for me a couple issues I'd love to have us put in the mix as we think about next steps for the bill. And I'm a co-chief sponsor on this bill, and I do know that it's really important, particularly as to public safety, that we don't leave any members of our community completely high and dry in that regard. Given that it is potentially really significant financial exposure for the state at a time when we're already in a deficit situation, I would be interested in potentially exploring a couple ideas to narrow the financial exposure. One might be to narrow the program to public safety-related funding only, because the fact that Douglas County isn't willing to fund its libraries doesn't mean that necessarily Clackamas County should fund its libraries instead, in my view. But I do think that, you know, everyone loses if the opportunity for, you know, significant drug trafficking, organized crime sparks in Josephine County or Douglas County because there is perhaps not the capacity to do enforcement that everyone would wish. So I'd like to see us potentially look at narrowing it to public safety, perhaps narrowing it to less than 50% match. And then also, you know, in Clackamas, in the Great Recession and beyond, there's been quite an effort at consolidation of service delivery. So I believe maybe Milwaukee has contracted with other communities to do, perhaps it's the Economic Development Office function, or I know a number of communities contract with the Sheriff's Department in Clackamas to operate their local public safety, and that enables folks to minimize back operating overhead and streamline expenses. I wonder if it might be possible to also condition or somehow incentivize communities in exploring the consolidation of service delivery. Maybe we can't have departments in each county that do X thing, but if they worked together and had one back office and offices in both counties, or two neighboring counties, maybe that would reduce costs but still enable residents to have certain services. So I think I'd like to see us get to some kind of a yes outcome. And again, I'm a co-chief sponsor on House Bill 3434, which would extend the sunset for emergency actions on public safety funding. But I think we also need to incentivize communities to do some of the things that Jackson County has done, as Rep. Marsh said, namely fill some of the gap. Representative Clem, did you want to make a comment?
I'm not sure I should, because once I start, it may not stop. But I'll try and make.
Now we're really interested.
Oh boy! Every now and then we talk about timber levels in rural Oregon, and I grew up in that white one, the Coos, and the challenge that I've had over the years is most of the solutions that I think are available in terms of having committees to create economic development strategies all involve federal law. So we can have all the county and or state committees we want, and that doesn't inherently change the dynamic. And in particular, I don't know how these counties or this state goes from at its high point, probably $8.8 billion in board feet, which maybe was too much, being harvested, down to $500 million, which is where we're at. And the Clinton Forest Plan even would have been $1 billion. Most people would take that at this point. But when you go from $8 billion to $500 million, and then people get welfare, and it was my boss, I worked for him when we helped create secure rural schools, welfare that they don't want when they'd rather work. I don't really blame people for voting against things, honestly, because it's a statement that they want their control of their lives back. And I don't think it should be viewed as a referendum that they don't value libraries or public safety. I think it should be a message that they that they are frustrated. I think they express themselves sometimes in federal elections that not sure they voted for the guy in their own interest in this case, but whatever. At least he may reform the ESA, and that's the only thing I might support that he does in 4 years. But if he does that, so there is some chance at getting to a reasonable harvest level, but people want the ability to work. And they're trying to find other ways in tourism and growing marijuana and everything else that happens in Southern Oregon to try and make an industry. But in the end, we have one big natural resource. And you're too polite to be angry about it, but I'm really angry and have been for a long time. I just usually try and bottle it up. But if the feds won't do anything, then I would like the state to do something. Marion County doesn't need to take them off the list until my commissioners, I said it. We don't need the money. We have plenty of public property off in Salem, and we figure out a way to do it anyway because we have functioning markets. But all you've got is trees. That's it. And until you can get in and cut them without being sued into oblivion, we should use state money, even if it comes out of my daughter's classroom, because I know it will pay back in the end more money if people could actually get to do work and earn income and payroll. I'll get more back here. But until that happens, I don't know what else to do. And I don't blame them for voting against those things. Other people I know blame them. Well, they don't vote for their own taxes. Well, I shouldn't swear in the record, so I think I'll stop now, but I don't blame them.
Chair Leininger.
Yes, please.
Representative Klim. Thank you for saying the things that I want to say, but...
You're Republican. I'm a Democrat. I can say it.
I'm trying to get a bill through committee.
Madam Chair, one footnote.
Okay, and then we're going to actually transition on.
I forgot to mention that the Association of Oregon Counties has a subcommittee that is working on Capitol Hill in partnership with the National Association of Counties to... develop an acceptable federal land management reform package that can pass, and we'll continue to do that as well.
Okay, great. Do we have any other comments from committee members? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be quick. And mine's mostly a comment, not a question. And I thank Representative Brocksmith for bringing this forward because it does open up a bigger issue here, and it's as Representative Klem said, it's counties that are reliant on timber, and in the 90s federal policy changed and significantly cut that, and the deal was we're going to cut your access to the forest, but we're going to give you payments in lieu of the revenue you would have gotten from taxation. And now the federal government's saying, well, we're not going to give you that either, good luck. And so I appreciate this bill. Is it trying to fill the gap or help the gap, but I think the real solution is to deal with the real problem. The real problem is how do we get back into forests in a responsible way that helps us be self-sustaining, because that's why people move there. It's ag and timber, and you've taken away that leg of the stool, and ag is suffering in those counties. So we don't have his county, my counties, don't have the five going up and down it, which is a huge economic driver. You take Marion County and move it somewhere else in the state, and it would be suffering just like the rest of us. So, and to back up to the bill we just heard before this, these communities also are lagging behind in internet access. And so I see that's something that it's not just access, it's broadband access and redundancy. And when you can buy land that's $1,000 an acre in Klamath County and, you know, set up your business there versus somewhere in Portland, but you don't have the same internet access, that's a box that all businesses have to check first before they move forward. And we just don't have that. So. Interesting bill, interesting conversation, but just wanted to get that on the record.
Madam Chair.
Excellent. You know, I'm going to go to Representative Lewis, please.
I'll make it brief, Madam Chair. I appreciate Representative Klem's comments, too, and I think for me it's about trying to find a long-term solution to this problem, and my hope is that regionally they're working on that, too, but there should be some way to regain access to federal forest land for timber as well. I don't know what the process would be for doing that, but But I thank you, Representative Klim, for those comments.
Thank you. I'm going to go to Representative Helm, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for all your work, Representative Rocksmith, over the years. I know this how difficult it is to thread the needle on these types of issues. I just wanted to point out a bright spot that I've learned about over the last couple of years and is coming through with the Department of Forestry's budget request this time, and that's a partnership between our Department of Forestry and the U.S. Forest Service to take over some of the management of federal forest lands and administrate the timber sales. It's been through a pilot project. It's been very successful. There's happiness on all sides, So folks that want to preserve the forests and folks that want to use the forests and the local communities that need the tax revenue. So there is there's a little bit of a bright spot. I think we do well to concentrate on how we modify the way that we work in the forest instead of continuing to insist that we need to go back to the good old days when we did have that 8 billion board feet coming out. That's the only way forward. Whether we like it or not, we live in a different reality now than we did in the 1980s, and it makes sense to me to look forward to collaborative solutions rather than look backwards.
Madam
right.
Chair,
yes,
if I may, before we transition, I appreciate all the comments, and I don't believe that there's anyone that would think that we would go back to the pre-1980 operations in the forest. But as the good representative mentioned, we would just like to be able to get into the forest without, and these are my words now, without the environmental for-profit, non-profit industry pushing back on us and filing even the and throwing everything at the wall to see what sticks with regards to appeals and anything moving forward as far as a timber sale. I could have, you know, sat here for an hour and talked about how the 6.4% unemployment rate that we have down in Southwest Oregon in my district compared to the 9% increase pre-recession growth that we have in Portland. I could have brought in the statistics on how many schools are on the free and reduced lunch, or how my school district and in Port Orford is the eighth most impoverished school district in the nation, and we have 15 graduates when 20 years ago there was 27, and it's a trend that isn't a trend that we want to have in our districts, or how what the drug use is because of the unemployment rates, and everything's systemic. Mm-hmm. And it all is based on the lack of the ability to utilize the natural resources that built the communities and are meant to sustain them. And you cannot just turn off the switch and say, okay, it's time for you to be a tourism-driven economy, when there's no road there. And with regards to direct access to I-5. And when you have a situation where, if you want to talk about housing, 30% of the houses owned in that area are owned by people that don't live in that area. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so I, again, appreciate the conversation. And thank you for the consideration. I wanted to bring you the bill in its raw form so that we can have an open discussion. I will work with Mr. Riddell on the input, and we'll have the we'll have a conversation about it and how we would like to see any amendments as we move forward. And I, again, thank you.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. All right, with that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3374. We have two more bills that we'd like to get through today. All right, so with that, I'm going to open work session on House Bill 2153, which has to do with commercial interior design registry. And I'm going to invite forward, after Mr. Crawford gives a brief introduction, Nikki Terziev and Legislative Council Representative Chuck Taylor to address a couple of issues that have come up. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee is being asked to consider the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2153. The Dash 2 amendments replace the measure. They require the Department of Consumer and Business Services to establish a voluntary certification program for commercial interior designers, provide standards for certification relating to experience, education, and successful completion of specified national accredited examinations, specifies qualified activities of certified commercial interior designers regarding submittal of plans, drawings, designs, and specifications, and supervision of the preparation thereof.
Okay, thank you. If you two could please come forward, that'd be great. I want to also note that we owe great thanks to Representative Marsh and Representative Brocksmith, who have led bipartisan work group, and also members of the interior design and architecture and engineering communities, and Cindy Robert, who I know has participated in those, and others. There has been great effort to try to get to consensus resolution of a number of issues. I understand that there is some question about the fiscal impact of the bill that potentially could be resolved on subsequent referral to Ways and Means, where the bill is designated to go should it pass out of this committee. And there is some difference of opinion, as I understand it, on some legal issues in which legislative counsel, which is the council that represents the legislature, sees no legal barriers and has carefully analyzed the issue, and the Department of Justice attorney on the matter has perhaps come to a different conclusion, which I will note is not unprecedented in our work or in the work of lawyers. So thank you both, and please give us an update, and we'll see, we'll think about the best way forward.
Thank you, Chair Leininger, members of the committee. Nikki Terziev here on behalf of the Interior Design Collaborative of Oregon. This is the Trade Association of Commercial Interior Designers. Less pillows and paintings, more lecture halls, hospital waiting rooms, restaurants. We did, in fact, work with your two gracious vice chairs. Thank you, Representative Brocksmith. Thank you, Representative Marsh. We spent quite a bit of time, and thank you with the other stakeholders, including the contractors. I want to note we spent quite a bit of time together on this little bill, and we were able to come out of, I believe, four or maybe five different work groups with these Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 2s provided neutrality, if you will, for other interested stakeholders, those who are around the construction table. Commercial interior designers, partners around the construction table, don't have a forever home in statute, and we also are seeking a little bit through this bill. We're seeking a little bit of kudos, a little bit of notoriety for the education, the three E's, the education, the experience that they have. They are folks who go through a master's degree program. These are professionals who know codes, who know math. They know the work, and yet they are kind of unaccounted for in statute. So this bill strive to put that home for them. It does aim to give them a registry, a voluntary registry. We are not aiming to preclude anyone else from doing this work, but if you are able to sit for the exam, it's a national exam that is recognized in the same structure as several other places in statute where a national exam is given the nod as a piece of certification that will allow you to have this kind of notoriety in the state of Oregon. And that voluntary registry would then allow them to have a number to walk into a planning office in either Medford or in Ashland or in either Port Orford or in Bandon and be able to say, these plans that I've had the oversight of putting together, these plans, these drawings, were done by a certified commercial interior designer, and that certified commercial interior designer is the one that's eligible for this voluntary registry at DCBS. So, you know, a lot of work has gone into this. I think there are, as you noted, Madam Chair, concerns around fiscal and some implementation that I would ask we address in Ways and Means. If this committee has accomplished its goal, which is to identify and resolve policy issues, and the fiscal issue is next, I would argue the most appropriate place for that is the Ways and Means, which is the subsequent referral, I do believe.
May I jump in? I also want to note that I believe that the fees that the interior designers pay attendant to joining this registry would pay the cost of the fiscal. So it's not an issue of cost borne by the general fund. It's an issue of how much would the interior designers have to cover through their own fee revenue and whether that is perhaps beyond what is feasible, but it's an issue to be borne by the designers themselves.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, that is correct. This would be a fee-funded program. We took great pains to include in the Dash 2's language, very specific, to acknowledge that we would appreciate anything that we could do to help implement and execute this program. We anticipate application fees that are separate and perhaps more robust to get the program off the ground from the annual fee or the renewal fee. In the quick math that I've been able to do, I've noted that the California fees, New Mexico fees, and a handful of other states are in this same range of what we would anticipate, around a $500 fee. So looking across the nation, it may not be the lowest, but it wouldn't be out of line with what we would anticipate. And it certainly is not close to approaching the fees that they pay in other ways for sitting for their professional exams or to open their own shops, right? This cost of doing business and a way to be recognized as an equal partner at the table.
Great. Thank you so much. Mr. Taylor, thank you for being here.
Chair Leininger, members, good morning. For the record, Charles Taylor from Legislative Council's office. As you know, the DOJ has raised some concerns about the Dash 2 amendments. And what I would say is I understand why they would reach the conclusions they did, looking at the face of the amendments in isolation. If you are looking past that and at some of the context provided by existing statute, I think that allows a different conclusion. The Dash 2s have a Section 1 and Section 2, and in Section 2 we list a number of instances where a certified commercial interior designer could submit plans, drawings, and specs. Those descriptions are actually taken from existing statute. If you look at the architect licensing provisions and, registration, and engineering registration statutes and construction contractor licensing statutes, they make exceptions from their requirements. So basically, what we are describing in Section 2 is what anyone could do. It doesn't require any type of special license or registration. The only requirement that we have in 455 that I know of as far as some kind of a certification is 455-645, which requires an architect or engineer certification for some of the larger public assembly structures if you are talking about foundation or framing or support work. And none of what we describe in Section 2 should be overlapping with that. So, viewing it in that context, the Dash 2s do a whole lot less than they appear to. I actually had to work very hard to have them do anything and not be totally redundant to what is existing law. I think it's fair to say they do the minimum that could be done without saying that they're a surplus. So because there is no current requirement, I disagree with DOJ saying that we're intruding on work that currently requires an architect or engineering, engineering registration. I think that was one of their issues with it. They also said it is not a voluntary system. It is. We state in Section 1, Subsection 7, that these two sections do not in any way limit or restrict commercial interior designer in their activities, whether they are certified or not certified. It simply has no effect on what type of activity they can do. So, again, that's a point where I disagree with DOJ. Section 1 provides that DCBS is to set the qualifications for the certification. So it is up to the agency to finally say who does or doesn't get certified. There is a reference in there to a national examination as one of the minimum qualifications. That is probably the strongest point the DOJ raises, but I don't think their conclusion is a necessary one. Certainly, if we were limiting someone in the practice of their occupation, then saying that they had to have some kind of a membership or certification in a private organization would be an unconstitutional delegation. We have a very different kind of situation here, since we are not affecting scope of practice and it is voluntary. DCBS does have the final say. There have not been a whole lot of cases I could find that brought up the issue of whether requiring passage of a national examination was somehow an unconstitutional delegation. I'm not aware of anything in Oregon on the point. I found three cases from other states that, of course, would be operating under their own law. In that instance, they basically said this is simply establishing a proof of competency issue. You either pass the exam or you don't, and doesn't raise the kind of barriers to entry that are the concern of delegating legislative authority. So basically, then what does the Dash 2 do? It does only one thing. As I said, it is minimal in its legal effect. And that is Section 1, Subsection 6. We create a conclusive presumption that if you have the certification and you're performing these activities in Section 2, you're exempt from the licensing or registration requirement. That is already the case since we have the statutory exemptions. Basically, the only thing that is going on here is we are short-circuiting the need to argue the point somewhat. If a board were to go after someone who had a certificate for one of these types of works where they shouldn't have, then arguably the certified commercial interior designer could point to the statute and say, look, we don't have to basically hope for a good decision from the ALJ. It's set out expressly. That is really about the only thing going on here. It does much less than I think a person would conclude just looking at the face of the amendment.
Okay, thank you. So, you know, what I perceive is that there were five work group meetings that that we had our bipartisan vice chairs host. Ms. Robert, I thank so much. Ms. Adams with the contractors, Mr. Koba, I believe someone from AOI participated in at least some of the meetings, all came to these. My sense is that the designers have been trying to get a bill like this for a couple of years, and this is sort of a scaled back version that has been worked really intently. And the question is whether it has essentially met the burden of meriting a referral to Ways and Means, where there will be an opportunity for continued conversation if anyone has concerns or if there needs to be a further discussion of legal issues, which our council has indicated are not problematic. That can happen there. If the fee amount is more than the designers are interested in bearing, and you sort of finalize the fee amount there in the committee, that its purpose really is to finalize the cost of things like that. We could have you discuss it more there. My hope would be that there would be support for us to refer this down, to pass this through the committee and enable it to move forward in ways and means. I'd love to hear if members of the committee have feelings one way or the other before we move forward with a possible work session vote. Does anyone have concerns about, Representative Marsh, please.
I don't have concerns, but I could speak to a little bit about the work group and the conclusions we came to. We did have about four or five meetings. We did have great participation from the realm of professionals who were involved here. I wouldn't say that they're enthusiastic about the final bill, but they did get to a place of neutrality, which is just as good in some ways. And we really addressed two major parts. One was qualifications for the commercial interior designers, and then that Section 2 scope of practice. And we realized when we addressed scope of practice that what we were really doing was carving out and delineating those areas that are not already in the domain of other professionals. So really, we've just brought together the functions that can, and as was stated earlier, be performed by anyone. And we are connecting them with the qualifications that are in Section 1 with the important nexus right in the middle, which is a message to building officials that people with these qualifications should be able to clear plans with the scope of practice that's defined. So really, it was, once we sat down and looked at it, a pretty simple process of just bringing those things together and making sure that there was language there to accomplish what it is the designers are hoping for. So I would support moving the bill forward. I'm not in a position to speak to the legal issues, not being part of that profession, but it seems to me that that Mr. Taylor's been able to do that functionally.
Thank you. Representative Brocksmith and then Representative Post.
Thank you. I just want to thank Representative Marsh. She's too gracious. She took this. This was our first work group, I believe. Was it not, Representative Marsh? And she facilitated fantastic meetings. And, you know, we thought we were there once, and then we weren't, and then we thought we were there once, and then we weren't, and then we thought we were there, and then we have this. Frankly, I don't want to spend any more time on this situation. I think that this thing has been through the grinder, and I appreciate legislative counsel and your opinion in your draft. I'm going to go with my work group colleague and move it down. And anyone who does not want to do that can then be on the future work group of the interior designers and how they want to. So, Representative
Post, please go ahead.
Sure. So I would have liked to have seen maybe perhaps somebody, whether it was Mark Long or somebody, to come in from DOJ and further explain their email letter that came out yesterday, which I understand LC has explained on their work and interpretation of it. I do not want to get in the middle of two attorneys. I just don't feel comfortable being there, and I don't want my hands on something that could someday become a legal issue. And I just don't feel like that's something I'm comfortable with. No, I don't want to be on a work group. I wouldn't. I would do a work group gladly. I go back to the original when we first heard this bill. I wrote notes to myself here for use down the road, which is what I love about this oldest system. I wasn't on the work group, so I may be speaking out of hand here, but could we not just create a registry, increase square footage that designers can work on, ensure their work does not involve structure mechanics of the building? It seemed like we could have made a very simple bill, and I understand everybody worked together, and I get that. We really complicated this, and I think it could have been done very simply and very easily, and then there's no fiscal, no ways and means, no lawyers in rooms yelling at each other, which they're not doing yet, but could one day. So that's why I'd rather not send the responsibility down to Ways and Means.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments? Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to agree with Representative Post. As long as there's this cloud hanging out there from DOJ saying that it appears to provide an unconstitutional and unlawful delegation of state authority, I would prefer to hear back from DOJ whether or not there's something that can be done with the bill that would change their opinion on that so that we don't have that hanging out there. So I have to oppose it as it is right now.
Okay, thank you. I will note that DOJ did not come to this meeting. So, you know, you can draw whatever inference you want to from the fact that they did not choose to come and describe why they are unable to support the position that our good attorney has supported. But I understand that good people can sometimes see issues differently, and I think it is a somewhat momentous occasion because perhaps this will be our first split vote on the House Economic Development and Trade Committee. But I would actually like to, out of respect for the tremendous amount of work and teamwork that people from kind of a range of views have been willing to commit to this project and the importance of enabling a profession that is seeking to dignify and give a little bit of sort of professionalization to move forward in that project, which they've been pursuing over years, I would love to move this forward to Ways and Means. And with that, Vice Chair Brocksmith, I'd welcome a motion.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 21st, 2017 for HB 2153.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 21st, 2017. Is there any discussion? Representative Gombert.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to go back to where we started with this measure, and it actually wasn't in this committee. It was in the Interim Small Business Growth Committee, who saw a group of professionals who were trying to distinguish themselves as professionals, which was why the committee moved the measure, well, introduced the measure, and it came to us. And I'm thinking of our first discussions here, where we acknowledged that we have this group of professionals that are trying to distinguish themselves from people who may have watched a couple of hours on the Home and Garden Channel and hold themselves out as interior designers. So I like the concept. And I recognize that we've had some questions. And I heard the two co-chairs say, or the two vice chairs say, that we put this through the grinder. I infer from their comments that this is as good as it gets, that taking more time isn't going to change it, isn't going to address some of the questions that are outstanding. This is as good as it gets. Now, I want to make it clear, because we've got some new members on this committee, and I want to respectfully remind them that when this goes to Ways and Means is not going to be concerned about the content. They're going to be concerned about the cost. It's our job here to address the content issues. It sounds to me like we have done that as well as we're going to be able to. And while there's some people that may feel we haven't gone far enough, I'm prepared to vote yes and move this along.
Okay. Thank you. So right now the motion is to adopt the Dash 2 amendments. If there are folks who want to oppose that, adopting the Dash 2 amendments, that's fine. We can take a roll call vote, or we can do a straight vote on this, and then we can go to a roll call as appropriate later. All right. Is there any more discussion? Any objection to adopting the Dash 2 amendments? Seeing none, the motion carries. And now for a motion on the bill.
Chair Leininger, I move House Bill 2153 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means Committee be had.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves House Bill 2153 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee be added. Is there any discussion?
My only discussion, Madam Chair, would be to have Representative Lewis and Representative Post on any future work that has to do with this.
All right, let the record so reflect. Any more discussion? Yes,
yeah,
please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only thing, again, this vote, I want to make sure this is not a reflection on the chair.
Yep.
It's not a reflection on the co-chairs that worked on this thing at all. It's a reflection of, as I said, legal issues that I'm still, like Representative Lewis said, a cloud. And I still, as Representative Gomberg has said, Ways and Means doesn't work policy. Maybe we could have done just another meeting. I don't know.
but that's where I'm at. So, but I want to make sure you know, I don't like breaking the string that we've been unanimous.
Well, I think good people can see issues differently, and I think that's and I very much appreciate those positive words, but I also I agree that good people can differ on issues from time to time, and that's okay. Any other discussion, and then we'll go to a roll call vote. Okay, could you please call the roll?
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Gomberg?
Aye.
Representative Helm?
Aye.
Representative Lewis?
No.
Representative Post?
No.
Representative Reschke?
No.
Representative Marsh?
Yes.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Aye. All right, with that, the motion carries. We do not need a carrier because it's going to Ways and Means. All right, thanks very much. And with that, the work session on House Bill related to interior design is closed. And now we are going to open another really important work session I'd like to try to get through. That is a work session on House Bill 2155 related to New Markets Tax Credits. And I'd like to call forward Craig Campbell to testify about some important work that's been done since we last spoke with Mr. Campbell. Mr. Crawford, could you please orient us?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2155, the committee is being asked to consider the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments replace the measure. They extend the sunset for tax credits for qualified equity investment to January 1st, 2023, increases the maximum amount of qualified equity investment that the Oregon Business Development Department may certify per tax year from $16 million to $24 million, caps fees paid to qualified community development entities at 3% of the qualified equity investment, exempts qualified active low-income community business from the requirement that they may not have more than 15% of their annual gross revenues from the rental or sale of rental of real estate if the income they receive is from the sale or rental of affordable housing, takes effect on the 91st day following signing day.
Thank you. And before we go to you, Mr. Campbell, I just want to note that this bill, as some others that we consider, has a subsequent referral. So it would subsequently go to House Committee on Revenue. What Mr. Campbell is going to speak to, I believe, I just want to summarize, is the fact that the bill is amended to limit transaction costs associated with use of the tax credit, which addresses a concern that some people had raised. And it's also amended to allow organizations that provide affordable housing to use this tool, thereby supporting a vision that many of us have, which is it would be great if we could help address the affordable housing crisis by increasing the supply of housing, and often that comes with ground floor commercial or ground floor community services or office headquarters for the nonprofits that run these facilities. So those are two features that are, I think, important. Mr. Campbell, please speak about those or other elements as you wish.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Coalition for Capital, talking to the Dash 2 amendments. You've done a pretty good job of covering what those amendments are going to do. They replace the existing bill. The one difference between the amendments we talked about last time I was before you and these is the addition of the allowance of these tax credits to be used for investments in low-income housing, where a portion of the project, if it's going to be used for rental space, must 100% of those spaces must be eligible for affordable housing. And so that's something that we have not allowed in Oregon. It's been allowable under the federal law. And so what we're doing is we're taking that federal provision that allows the tax credit to be used for affordable housing, and we're allowing it to be used in Oregon. The idea behind the original Oregon law was we didn't want folks just basically doing developments for rental. We wanted this program to be used for creating jobs and growing jobs. However, because of the situation in Oregon dealing with affordable housing, whether you happen to be out in Hermiston or Bend or Portland, there are a lot of areas in the state that have this problem, and this would allow this tax credit to be used in whole or part for projects that cover that. It doesn't require it to be used for that. It doesn't set a limit on that, but it does say that it can be used for that. As the chair also indicated, this bill imposes a cap on the fees that can be charged by those who put these plans together. There's been some concern about how big those fees can get, and so we're capping them at 3%, which is the federal cap, which means that if you've got federal involvement, essentially they're going to have to live within the means of the project that they're putting together at the federal with the federal tax credit here in Oregon. I would like to indulge very quickly and thank a couple of entities. One, Business Oregon has been the ones who have been the stewards of this program, and they have done a fantastic job, so I wanted to say that. They, of course, must remain neutral on the bill as a state agency, but I don't have to be neutral about how good a job they've been doing for us. And the other thing, Legislative Council, we have Kate Toswell and Legislative Council, and you as Legislative Council never want to be the person who gets to deal with a complicated equity program from the federal government, and she has. She's learned it well, and so when we go in and talk, she knows her stuff. So I wanted to thank both of those folks.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Any questions for our colleague here at the witness table? Yes, Ms. Marsh, Representative Marsh, pardon me.
Thank you, Chair Leininger. I have a small little question that came up in a conversation yesterday from an organization that was looking at using these, which is that there seems to be some limits when we move to the realm of affordable housing that would screen out people with felonies on their records in terms of the way that
Madam Chair, Representative Marsh, I cannot speak to that. I have not heard of that prior to this, but I can certainly look into it. If that is the problem, it certainly isn't a problem through the New Markets Tax Credit. It would probably be something along the lines of requirements about affordable housing and how HUD makes their allocation.
I think that's true. I just wondered if there was any support we could give to, you know, broadening that population in this effort. Maybe we're if we're inevitably tied to those federal requirements, maybe not, but it's a significant issue when you look at trying to broaden the use of the tax credit, because so many of our folks have you know, backgrounds that are not perfect.
No, I will say in my other job with the Public Defender's Office, I work on matters to help people with prior criminal justice system involvement expunge past offenses from their records, and after a certain amount of time, there are a number of kinds of felonies that can be reduced or expunged from the records, and a key reason why that's important is so that people can get access to affordable housing, because I think some of the funding streams prevent people with certain kinds of criminal justice system involvement from being able to enter affordable housing units. So I'm not aware of it being in any way related to this funding stream, but I think it is an important issue, and good news is there's some groups working to try to address it, but I appreciate your raising that. Any other comments? All right, I would welcome a motion on this. No.
We do not have the paperwork.
I'm sorry, we don't have the paperwork. I would welcome the paperwork on this. All right, but thank you very much for coming forward. We will consider this for a work session just as soon as we have the paperwork. Thanks very much. Closing the work session on House Bill 2155. And Representative Clem, I would be happy to open a work session on House Bill 2041 if you feel like it would be useful in this short amount of time, or we could carry it over to tomorrow or Monday. What is your preference?
We can do it now.
Okay. So open a work session on House Bill 2041. And Mr. Crawford, if you could do the honors of providing some context.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2041 was first heard in this committee on February 22nd. It establishes the Certified Oregon Program within the Oregon Business Development Department to certify for-profit and nonprofit businesses to use the term Certified Oregon when advertising. Creates the Certified Oregon Advisory Group to advise and make recommendations to Business Oregon to implement the program and certify businesses. Specifies advisory group membership. Requires Business Oregon Advisory Group to report to the Legislative Assembly on or before September 15th. 2019 regarding the implementation of the program.
All right. Do we have Ms. Representative Clem, would you like to make any statement to orient us?
Yeah. Committee, we talked about this earlier. After talking with Business Oregon, their fiscal is pretty good size, so I think I'm going to have to do more work if I actually ever want to get it out of Ways and Means. Uh-huh. But I think generally you understand the concept. So if we can get it down there, then we can make sure it doesn't die, and I can work on how to make it a little bit less painful on the budget. I think it's like $250,000 or something like that, which is probably a little high. I think there's probably ways that we could do something like the wine board did, where people who use the term and the label that was designed for the wine industry paid a little assessment to do it as a way to get some revenue. Mm-hmm. But this will take some creative math if we want to get it out of Ways and Means, I'm sure.
Okay. Any other comments? All right. So we have here a proposed. Any other comments? Proposed motion to Ways and Means without recommendation and acknowledgement of the fact that you're still planning to do some work on it. But I think it's a really promising and important bill, and I'd like to see it move forward. So thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Great. Well, I'm signed on for it. I'm
You want to do it with a recommendation? I would welcome a motion with a recommendation.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2041 with a do-pass recommendation to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves House Bill 2041 with a do-pass recommendation to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Sometimes we go off script and terrible things happen. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? A discussion, Representative Gomberg.
Yeah, I raised my hand for discussion, not objection.
Yeah,
Chair.
Please, for discussion.
Yeah, I know the co-chair of the Transportation Economic Development Committee pretty well. Representative Clem's right. This is going to be a heavy lift, but let's keep it alive and give it a shot. I think it's a good program.
That's great. Thank you. That is the kind of can-do spirit that we like in the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade.
If I can just add, I'm the chair of the Southern Oregon China Connection for the Oregon Sister State China Relations Council. And we had on Friday in your county, Madam Chair, the annual Economic Development and Trade meeting with the Chinese delegation focusing on e-commerce. And that focus on e-commerce had to do with being able to have access to over 400 million people, online to sell products to Oregon, which we have already an $8 billion trade industry with. And so being able to see if we can't brand our products certified Oregon through this concept will only drive those figures higher and create more economic development opportunities for our local economies. And we talk about rural, we talk about broadband. These are the type of things that, you know, Gladys can crochet her various items, or our cranberry growers can export, or so. Thank you.
Excellent. Anyone else have comments they'd like to add? Okay, so we are through discussion. Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. And there you go.
Our streak is back.
And with that, we will adjourn. Ending on a high note. The adjourn. Ending on a high note. The that we will adjourn.